Hello, everybody. This is Ground Zero Growth. I'm your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbod. I'm joined today with my guest, Krista Shelton, president and founder of Focused Forensic Solutions. How are you doing today, Krista?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm fantastic. So I feel like it's only appropriate to draw attention to the fact that you and I are recording this on Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. And I was kind of just thinking about as we're going into the recording, and I went into the office to kind of catch up on some things, how it really seems like when you go out on your dream, days off aren't quite as you might have expected them to be. Do you share that sentiment?
I mean, I sure do. In fact, I was actually just in Cancun for a wedding this past week. And, even being outside of the country, it's you still have to answer your phone and check on emails. And but that's part of it. And that's why we do what we love. So
It sure is. It's quite the adventure. Whenever I had my daughter, I remember a moment even when I'm like taking a phone call while holding her while she's screaming. It was a fun multitask ordeal. So, Chris, I'd like to start kind of the initial line with kind of tell me about where did you grow up initially, and what was kind of your first dream?
Well, so I grew up in the Kansas City area, Blue Springs specifically, and went through high school, that entire area, and then went to college in Kansas City, started out at UMKC and ended up getting my degree from Park University. So kind of always been in this area, have traveled a little bit and have lived in St. Louis in the past, but focused on Missouri for sure.
So how did you end up then where you're at currently now? Slight beeline on.
This is a great story because so I live in Maryville, Missouri. I just built a house on a 400-acre farm that's been in our family since 1856. I'm actually the sixth generation to be up here. And shortly after I left working for the government, I started spending a lot of time up here just to I was studying for my CFE exam, certified fraud examiner. And I can't explain it. I sat outside a lot and just felt this pull. I just felt like this was where I was supposed to be. And so I went to my father and I said, I've got a question for you. And he said, I know exactly what you're going to ask. And I thought, there's no way that he's going to think that I'm going to, relocate to this kind of remote area. And sure enough, that's exactly what he guessed. And, at the time, I just wanted to know if it was possible, because if it wasn't, then I would just be able to shut that off in my brain and not spend any more energy on it. But the answer was yes. In fact, let's do it sooner than later. And the very next day, he was sending me house plans on, via email. And I moved into my house about a year later.
Excellent. Well, that's a fantastic hook that we're going to have to kind of like pause, but I can, it's going to come up again. So what was then that first real dream as you're going to like UMKC and you're getting your degree? And what was kind of the first thing where you're like, I'm going to do this, or I want to do this?
I always kind of had the entrepreneurial spirit. I knew accounting, tax, math, that
where
was
do
really
you think that came from, that bug?
Well, math was always my favorite subject. I liked the fact that it was black and white. 2 + 2 was always going to equal 4. And then I actually ended up working at a company, at a corporation, all through college. And I started out as an administrative assistant and then made my way into the accounting department, was accounts payable clerk, and then was accounts payable administrator. And by the time I left, I was the general ledger analyst and revenue accountant for this $380 million a year company. And so I was able to get so much experience, going through that whole process and learning all those different job responsibilities. But, I started working for the IRS right after college. And my original plan was to work there for 10 years, get my CPA license, and then start my own CPA firm. Because I kept thinking, like, well, who would you rather have, prepare your tax returns? Like somebody who has audited them. And so...
And how did the IRS recruit you, or did you find them?
Well, I went to a job fair that was put on by
Okay.
UMKC and was recruited through that and then started right after
Okay.
that.
God, I was more curious because it's, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think most people come out of accounting school like, IRS, let's go.
That's very true. But I mean, I just the whole time just kept thinking like there's no better experience that I'll ever get than working for the Internal Revenue Service. And so, you know, it's interesting because I actually started out as a revenue agent where I was auditing small business tax returns. You know, my job was basically to look at specific issues and then determine whether they needed to be adjusted. So, you know, I was checking shoeboxes of receipts and going through general ledgers and QuickBooks and that kind of thing. And I ended up having two fraud cases. So two cases where I recognized that there were some indications of fraud and then referred them over to the criminal side of the IRS. And so in those situations, most of the time, the special agent who's working the case will have the revenue agent be a cooperating agent. And so I was spending, you know, days in cars with special agents going to try to interview and find witnesses. And it was at that time that I knew like that was the job for me. That's exactly where I belonged. And so I ended up switching over and becoming a special agent and did that job for about 10 years.
So tell me about in the case of fraud, is it so you mentioned two cases, and you specifically said you were involved in two cases of fraud. I'm kind of thinking through all the different cases and audits that you're going through and a lot of them, and there's but two that are fraudulent. So what I'm trying to, my question is, did those individuals know, knowingly involve themselves in fraudulent activity? And that's part of why they were the two cases, or are there a lot of people out there accidentally committing fraud?
Well, so that's very interesting because the Title 26 is tax and the tax crime code, you know, for the federal code. And Title 26 is the only code where you have to prove willfulness in order to prosecute somebody for a tax crime. And so that is actually one of the elements. So you have to prove that it wasn't just an accident. You know, there wasn't a CPA that just transfer to zero or whatnot. We had to prove that they willfully, intentionally, you know, committed that fraudulent act. And so, like the first case I had was a roofing company, and what I ended up discovering was that in their bank account there was about $200,000 a year in gross receipts that were not on the tax return. And so once I recognized those indicators, at that point we refer the case over to the criminal side so that they can work a criminal investigation on it.
When you had mentioned, I think in one of the presentations I saw before, you had mentioned tells essentially in scenarios where a good example you gave was somebody's living in a much larger house than what they're reporting for salary. And that's probably like a stereotypical example of relatively easy at that point to point to. No, they know what they're doing. I mean, their house is five times their salary that.
Right. And I mean
Who doesn't
that
know
was
what they're
something
doing?
that, you know, after reviewing tons of tax returns, that was a scenario I came across quite often. And it was, you know, somebody that was reporting $30,000 in income, but they're living in a $1 million house. We call that a clue. And so it's all about piecing together those clues and then gathering all the evidence. And it's also, you know, it's been happening every year. The amount's increasing every year because they get more, you know, more and more greed takes over. So there's lots of different scenarios that we look for, but there's no
Interesting.
shortage of fraud. I mean, that's for sure.
How do you prove willfulness? That's gotta be a fun one.
Well, it is. And again, it's a pattern, right? So if it's
Okay.
1 year out of five that this happened, that might not go towards the willfulness part of it. But if
Got it.
they've been doing it for 4 years and every single year the amount has been increasing, then that would be a good telltale sign that something's happening. You know, it's
Gotcha.
also who is in charge of the records. So are they passing them off to a bookkeeper who's actually, you know, inputting the transactions into an accounting software program? You know, we talk to a lot of witnesses. So, you know, we always try to find witnesses that are going to help us tell the story to a potential jury. And so, you know, again, there's lots of different ways to prove it, but those are some of the main ones.
That's interesting. So I hear about it almost like a scorecard in my mind. It's like, after so many, it's like, well, sorry. Okay, so all right, so this was interesting too, and you're starting to bridge into kind of your first arrest, how you talked about, you transitioned, you were an assistive party to these special agents as a result of being involved in, a couple cases of fraudulent activity, clearly fraudulent activity. And they were probably larger cases, I'm guessing, too, because you only mentioned two, and it sounds like you were probably involved in quite a few audits. Is that correct?
Sure,
Can
yes,
you
absolutely.
describe the makeup of the two that differentiated them more? Because I'm curious. You
Yeah,
probably
well,
processed a ton.
the first one was this roofing company, and again, that was just a lot of unreported income. So $200,000 a year for several years, and that really added up. The
Gotcha.
second one was actually much different. It was kind of a technology-based company, and they were going out and getting a lot of investments from individuals. And so we would see a lot of $5,000 to $10,000 checks from, farmers and people in the area that they grew up in. And what they ultimately were doing was paying a lot of personal expenses out of a credit card. And so during the audits, while I was, going through it, I had to request all of those credit card statements, and then ultimately, was able to calculate it just, hundreds of thousands of dollars in personal expenses that were then being paid by the corporation and deducted on their tax returns. And so that's what ultimately we referred the case over to the criminal side for.
So in that criminal side bit, this was kind of interesting because the first time you explained your arrest, which we can dive into, but the way you described it was kind of a moment of, oh, the IRS almost seems to have like an FBI side of its organization, which makes a lot of sense. But I don't think, like, if more of us envisioned the FBI side of the IRS, I think probably more of us wouldn't need to be recruited out of college. We might voluntarily go to that because it sounds a lot more intriguing than what typically goes through the average person's mind when they hear IRS.
I agree. And, when I talk about being a special agent and being with the IRS, one of the things that people often comment on is like, you carried a gun? Like, the IRS has people who carry guns? And so, yes, I mean, being a special agent is a federal government's position. They call it an 1811. And almost, I mean, there's tons of different agencies that have special agents. So FBI is the one that probably people think of the most. Homeland Security, even FDIC has special agents, FSA. Let's see. I mean, there are an absolute enormous amount of special agents that are out there. But IRS does absolutely have federal agents that work criminal cases. And, these are the ones that people go to jail for. So this is tax evasion. And we did a lot of money laundering cases. We investigated banks for violating bank secrecy acts and not having proper anti-money laundering procedures in place. So we did work a wide range of cases, but ours were mostly focused on the Internal Revenue Code. And in fact, we are like special agents with the IRS are the only agents out there that can prosecute, or not prosecute, but investigate tax crimes. So FBI wouldn't even be able to open up a tax case because they don't have jurisdiction on that. Just IRS can.
Interesting then. So there are they typically referring that out then, I'm guessing. So, well, I mean, let's kind of go to a famous one. It was Al Capone, right? That was ultimately caught on tax evasion. So is that a scenario where they're ultimately either referring to or looping in the IRS on like, hey, we can't get him on murder. Help.
Right. So that one's a very interesting one because in almost every single IRS office, at least in the criminal side, there is a standard poster that we use all the time, and it says only an accountant could catch Al Capone. And so the entire theory about that one was, they had a hard time proving, the dangerous acts, the corruption that he was doing, the racketeering. But they actually created an entirely new way of determining income each year, and they call that the net income method. And what they did was they looked at what his net income is from one year, and then counted it at the end of the year. And the only way that, I mean, the only thing that would have justified that increase would have been income. And so that is a method that is still used today to determine income in a tax fraud case.
Tell me that one more time, because I think I missed something there. I just went over my head there, I think. Help me
Yeah,
out.
so
So
they
they
call it
determined
the net income method of
Okay.
determining unreported income. And so
Okay.
what they do is they start at, January 1st. Here is his net worth. So here's all of his assets, here's his
Gotcha.
liabilities, and we come up with his net worth. And then they'll
Gotcha.
calculate it at 12/31. What is his end of the year net income or net worth, right? And so the
Okay.
difference, if his net income increases, then
His
that
net
has to
worth.
be because of income. Yes,
Okay, got okay.
his net worth increases
Gotcha.
from the
Okay.
beginning to the end of the year. Then unless there's some other explanation, then that has to be unreported income.
Ah, wow. Okay. And what did they call this again?
They call it the net income, or sorry, net worth method.
The net worth method. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So if somebody's net worth in January is significantly different from their net worth in December, and it's not like they happen to hold shares in Apple that went through the roof on that year, then it has to be unreported income.
Right.
Okay.
And we take into consideration any sort of non-taxable income. So we would look at inheritances or, what if a person won the lottery? I mean, those are
Sure.
explanations we would take into account.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a million reasons for it, and there's multiple millions of reasons not, right? So that makes sense. Okay. So and so that Al Capone, how they got him ultimately was his net worth was significantly increasing, and he's not reporting XYZ income. So, well, this is a lot of fun in an unexpected route. Let's talk about that because it is Al Capone, I want to say. There's, if you go to the IRS tax code, it's like even towards the top. It's one of the few things in the code that I've bothered to read because it's more interesting. It's like if you have income, legitimate or not, it must be reported. Can we kind of talk about that? I'm not getting it word for word, but I bothered to take a snapshot of it and send it to my friends because it was just the funniest thing I'd seen.
That is very interesting because a lot of times when we would work embezzlement cases, embezzlement income is still income and must be reported on a tax return. So even illicit income is still included in the tax code as income. So, drug dealers, if they're making a bunch of money, they should be reporting that income on their tax returns. In fact, there's
So
actually
this is if is that is that okay? Let's just assume a drug dealer is listening right now, right? And they're like, "Well, I obviously don't want to get caught. That's kind of, but I also want to avoid if I ever do get caught, I want to avoid going to jail for as much as I possibly can avoid going to jail for." Can you report income to the IRS and not have that just immediately slide over to the FBI? Like, hey, by the way, you might want to look at this.
Yes, I mean, absolutely you can. In fact, I remember getting training very, very early on in my career at the IRS where drug dealers are not allowed to claim any other business expenses. So you can't claim your mileage, you can't claim your cell phone bill. The only thing you're allowed to claim as an expense is the cost of goods sold.
Is the
I think most
cost
people are really surprised to learn that.
of goods sold? So they can claim drugs as an expense, but they can't claim
And I'll
mileage.
tell you, I've never actually seen a tax return where a drug dealer has ever claimed any income. I mean, it's just not something that
Well,
we've ever
that's
seen,
fair.
but
That's fair, but I believe probably not many, but I like to imagine there is a drug dealer out there with a very good accountant that says, "This is how we operate if you don't want to go to jail for tax evasion." Well, you might end up in jail over murder, but no tax evasion.
Well, and that is interesting too, because most of the time these guys IRS does get involved in a lot of the drug cases. Usually there's one agent for every major city that's assigned to that. To work with DEA and a bunch of locals on the drug cases. And most of the time what we do in those cases is look at money laundering charges. So it's because they're taking all their illegal proceeds and then trying to make them appear like they're legitimate income. And that's where we'll get them most of the time.
Right. Oh, wow. Okay. So there's so money laundering. So my mind now has gone to weed and marijuana, which is legal now in some states, but not so legal. And what seems to be interesting to me is there seems to be this accepted point in where it's no longer money laundering. So, if certain banks, right, you can support weed adjacent, marijuana adjacent, and then that's okay. But if you're the actual dispensary, that's not marijuana adjacent, and that's no longer okay. But supporting marijuana adjacent means they're taking money from marijuana, means like at what point is this not money laundering? And at what point is it? And at what point does it become just accepted? Like it is money laundering, but the states think it's okay. And unless we want to go back to a civil war, we're going to have to be careful.
Right. And the thing that I have dealt with the most in my career as it relates to marijuana becoming legal was more on the banking side. And banks are not allowed to accept knowingly accept illegal proceeds into their accounts. And that's part of the anti-money laundering procedures. It's Bank Secrecy Act is kind of the major law that kind of talks about that. And so when they started making it legal, there was a lot of questions about whether banks were going to be able be allowed to, bank these types of customers. And I don't know enough about it to be able to speak on the details of it, but I know it is something that is very widely known, and they've been working through those issues. But I mean, honestly, at this point, like, let's just make it legal and then not have to worry about it anymore. I mean, that's my personal opinion on it, so but we'll
No,
see.
that's fair. No.
Yeah, because
So
the
we've gone
dangerous part
off.
about that is all the cash. I mean, if they're only accepting cash, and now you've got armored vehicles that are picking up the cash, and then what do you do with the cash? And I mean, it's become it was a big problem at one point when that first started coming around.
Right. Yeah. I think it's, it's weird because to your point, you say it was a big problem. I think it still probably is. I just think now at this point, there's enough weird gray area in these weird places that it's become less of a problem only because we found weird ways around it. Like, I actually have a friend of mine, and I asked him at one point, I was like, hey, out of curiosity, because he's in the credit card industry, I was like, is there a way where dispensaries can take credit cards? And he's like, if they're doing over $1 million a month, then yes. And it involves this weird offshore pathing. But and I'm guessing it's gray area legitimate because he seemed pretty direct about it. It didn't seem like a under the conversation. So anyway, okay, we've gone off a little bit, but diving back to it. So how long were you with the IRS? And let's go into that first arrest for the listeners because I've heard it a couple times, but it is an exciting one. So I think we've set the stage for the IRS has this arm, a little bit relates to the FBI kind of, and you'd said there's other oh shoot, like the FDIC and whatnot that also carry weapons. So let's talk about that and that first arrest.
Sure. So I worked at the IRS for 13 and a half years. Again, I started as a revenue agent and did that for about 3.5 years. And in that position, I was responsible for evaluating and going over tax returns and making adjustments when appropriate. I did that. And again, I had a couple fraud cases that kind of piqued my interest into moving over to the criminal side. And ultimately became a special agent back in 2010. Had to spend 6 months of training down in Georgia at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, which was very interesting, very difficult, but very rewarding time of my life. In fact, half of my class was Secret Service for the first 3 months, and so still have some buddies over there that are, out there protecting the president, and very interesting. And so, I ended up moving over to the criminal side. So this is back in 2010. I was 2 weeks on the job, brand new to St. Louis as an agent. And I get really excited because I get assigned to go on my first like big law enforcement operation. And it turns out it is a huge citywide takedown of a drug conspiracy. And so citywide, we were arresting like 18 people. And it was a case being investigated by DEA, IRS, and then a bunch of locals. And so they split us up into teams where each team had 3 people to arrest that next morning. And so there I am at like 7 o'clock in the morning, pulling up to this McDonald's parking lot, and you can see all the feds outside. It looks like, a scene out of the movie. They've got all their bulletproof vests on, they've got their guns on their hips, and there I am, like brand new agent, and popping my, popping over there. And so as soon as everyone gets there, the DEA agent starts his pre-op briefing. And so, he starts off showing us a photo of his of the subject we're going to, last known address. Steve's got the RAM. If you get shot, go to the nearest hospital, kind of all the standard stuff. But then he stops and he says, "This one might be a little tricky because we think this guy just murdered a snitch last week." And I mean, it took everything in my power to like keep a straight face. But internally, I'm thinking like, what? Like, I did not sign up for this. Like, I'm supposed to be arresting doctors and lawyers and CPAs, like not drug dealing murderers who, are probably linked to the cartel in some way. And so
So
we ended up, sorry.
I kind of want to no, I kind of want to take a momentary pause here because I'm hearing imposter syndrome hardcore, and I think this is the first time I've recognized that as being imposter syndrome, and I've had weird moments of it myself where it's almost like, at least for me, it's almost like a voice screaming at you like, this isn't where you're supposed to be, run, right? And in that moment, to your point, you're almost having to like smother it because you're like, I've got to keep a straight face or they're gonna smell it, right? And then there's no way I'm doing this anymore. That's really interesting to me because yeah. Sorry, I just have you dealt with that since? Let's kind of zero on that in a little bit,
That's a good
the
question. And
imposter syndrome.
no, I don't believe I have. And to be honest, that was the only time I ever, well, that's not true, because I did go on other, drug related arrests and did drug surveillance and that kind of thing too. But no, that was, again, it was 2 weeks on the job. This is my first time and I'm just nervous and,
Yeah.
just like we all are when we have to go do something important and it's the first time. So
Different, yeah.
yeah, he wasn't end up, he did not end up even being there. And so we actually went to, I don't know if you've actually heard this part of the story, but we ended up going to the second house and we found this guy right away. And the guy that I rode out there with was an IRS agent, still a close friend of mine named Pat. And we end up the transport team. And so we, this guy is in a wife beater. We put some sandals on him. I remember he was begging us for a cigarette because we woke him out of bed, first thing in the morning. And once you're handcuffed, like there's, sorry, you're going straight in. We're not going to stop and allow any of that kind of thing happen. And so we end up putting him in the front seat of Pat's car, and I got behind him, and then Pat was driving. And Pat is one of those guys that could talk to anybody. He was a, he could just shoot the shit with anybody. And so we're taking this 20-minute drive down to the DEA office, or their headquarters in St. Louis. And I'll never forget this because Pat was just talking to this guy, but every time this guy opened his mouth, the entire car would fill up with morning breath. Because again, we don't even let them brush their teeth or anything. And I remember just thinking like, what? Like, stop talking. But so that was my actual first arrest.
Interesting. That's interesting. Man, that's got to be a tough way to quit smoking.
Yes,
I
I'd
mean,
say. I felt bad for the guy, but
it's hard enough to cold turkey, let alone cold turkey because you were obligated to by
right.
the It's one of those things where it's like it's not even willpower at that point. It's your obligation.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. So what had you tell me about the progression through that then, and what had you decide to leave?
Okay. Well,
And did you
again, I
decide to
always
leave
had.
first before you knew where you what you were going to do, or
No, I mean, I always kind of had the entrepreneurial spirit. And like I
you
said earlier,
mentioned that. So when I said where'd the bug come from, I meant the entrepreneurial spirit, not the accounting bug.
yeah. So my ex-husband was an entrepreneur,
Okay.
and he had started a company before him and I met, and then we actually started a company together where he was doing websites, like building websites. And
Okay.
so that's kind of what I think where it all kind of started.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And then,
And where was
again,
that
I
in
ended
this
up spending 10
journey?
years. Say that again.
Where was that in this journey? Was that around the college or
I'm,
the, if we can
I,
kind of
yeah, we
plateau
got
onto it.
married. So I actually met him when I was 18, at that first company that I'd worked for. And then we got married, the year that I started working at the IRS.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. All right. Gotcha. And was he there for this first arrest in St.
No,
Louis?
we split
Okay.
up when I became a special agent and moved to St. Louis.
Gotcha. All right. Fair enough. Yeah, that'd have to be. Yeah.
And like I said, I kind of intended on getting a CPA license and preparing tax returns for a living, but
Right.
now that I've had all this experience doing more of the forensic accounting and doing the fraud investigations, then that seemed, like the natural place to go. And so I left the government in January of 20, and then got my C got sorry start, studied for my certified fraud examiner license and got that in August, and then started my company in August of 2020.
August of 2020. All right. That's exciting. So tell me about okay, so now I've got where the kind of the bug came from, and you decided that was the route you wanted to go. What, and then I can see now why you would want to start like a fraud examiner and investigation company. How's that journey been? I mean, meeting you at a networking group, which is where we met for anybody listening, was kind of, and then I'm a certified fraud examiner and investigator, and I'm like, that's the first time I've ever met one of those. Can you tell me about your journey from that point on? How's been meeting people and saying that? Are there a lot of fraud examiners, investigators out there that I'm just not actively aware of?
Well, there's quite a few that are certified fraud examiners, and they'll have that license. But most of them, in my experience, have positions within other organizations. So they might be auditors, in, big, large corporations. A lot of banking, employees will have that certification. And then there's, a handful of us that have our own firms that do forensic accounting and fraud investigations. And, starting off, it was just me. And the best way for me to get my name out was just to, again, show up at the networking events, try to get as many presentations as I can. So getting in front of attorneys is something that helps my company a lot. And so I do a lot of continuing legal education for attorneys. And at this point, I mean, I just offer them for free just to get my name out there. And if somebody's going to hire a forensic accountant as an expert witness, my experience, they're not going to Google to search for somebody. They're going to call their buddy or, use somebody that has been a referral of some sort. And so, it's been interesting coming on to this, the kind of the private side of this, because I don't, honestly, one of the biggest struggles is I don't have the same resources as I did. I can't just issue a subpoena or a summons to get bank records. I have to rely on my clients to get the records for me, rely on the courts to, issue the subpoenas or the law, the lawyers to do that if need be. But I'm really much more limited into public information that's out there, as opposed to having the government, behind my name. So that's been a very interesting difference.
Wow, yeah, okay. So that's yeah. Because I mean beforehand it's like, from the office of the IRS, it's like get them everything they need now and let's move on
Right.
versus interesting. Yeah. So do you have an example you can give there then where it was particularly hard to get records and for a minute there you were like, I don't know how we're gonna pull this off, but you did.
Well, I'm actually going through that right now. And this is kind of a sad story. I just got a call a couple of days ago from an individual who discovered that his partner's been stealing from him. And so the first thing I do, before anything else, like we've got to, secure the accounts. Let's stop the bleed before we do an investigation. And the good part is that the fraud's already happened, so you can't change it. And there are records there. But he wasn't sure if he was on the bank accounts or, and at this point, he actually mentioned that he tried to log on to his former, online banking login and was told that, you no longer have an account. So at some point, his partner took him off the accounts. And so my first suggestion in that regard was like, you would need to go immediately to the bank and talk to somebody there and just explain the situation and see what information you can give.
What was the equity split?
It was two guys, 50-50. But what was interesting, and this, you know, this guy was in a position where he had no accounting information. And we see this often. You know, small business owners are really good at what they do. They're not so good at the accounting and the financial part of this. And so, you know, even when he was on the phone, I jumped on Secretary of State, and there were two different businesses that had been started. One of them had his name on it as the organizer, and then one of them had his partner's name on it, but they were two completely separate companies. And so I ended up, you know, sent those over to him so he could take them to the bank. And, you know, at this point, he went to the bank. They were not going to provide him with any records. I just got an email this morning that he was actually able to get some records. And I think that was probably during the period where he was on the account. But in that scenario, you know, I can't just go to the bank and go get those records for him. And if he's not on the account, he can't go get those either. And so we're going to have to get an attorney involved. There's going to have to be a lawsuit filed. You know, depending on how much it is, we could get law enforcement involved. And in that case, they would be able to issue subpoenas or summonses to get the information. You know, and again, the thing I kept telling him was, you know, at this point, you know, open up a new account or start a new company, either way, but you want to make sure that you have control to the account that you need, right? So that way, if you receive business income, you can go ahead and deposit it into an account. But as far as looking back, like, we will get the records one way or another, right? And at this point, the fraud has already happened. It's historical. And so there's no risk in waiting a month or two. I mean, it's already, like I said, it's already happened. And going back and you know, reconstructing that is what we do, right? That's what we do best is once we get the records that we need, then we can make a determination of what was fraudulent and write a report and proceed with a fraud case. You know, I have another scenario where I was involved in a large investigation, fraud investigation, where an executive director was stealing from a charity. And in that scenario too, you know, they had a list of the accounts, the board members did, but she had gone out and opened up new accounts for under the charity name, opened up credit cards. And so we were lucky that we were able to find them all. But in that scenario, you know, we didn't have that information readily available. We had to really search for it.
Yeah, well, and yeah, sorry, there's so much going through my head, 'cause it's fascinating how, and I know, I mean, I think part of the reason we get along just fine, Chris, is 'cause we kind of live in this world, this darker mental, almost paranoid and sometimes world, where it's like we see it enough that in our mind it's kind of like you wouldn't stop by the bank and check to see if your name was on the account. But for those that don't, it's like, ah, that'll never happen to me. Like, we're good friends. He knows my wife. You know, we're best. But
Nobody ever thinks they're going to be a victim of fraud.
no, it happens
And
in an instant, right? I mean,
it
it's
does. And most of
some
the time,
old.
especially in financial fraud, it's generally somebody who is in a trusted position. So it is your business partner or your office manager or your bookkeeper. You know, it's going to be the person that's working for you for 15 years that shows up to your family gatherings. Those are the people
Yeah.
that commit this type of occupational fraud.
Well, it's so interesting too, because like in the case of nonprofits, that would be a fun one to talk about, because that's such a different, I think a difficult, frankly, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think I am, organizational structure, such that smaller businesses, nonprofit businesses, struggle to kind of keep up. And, you know, I've even had a friend that they had to go as far as like, you guys have to update the bank account records, or I'm going to go and take the money because you haven't updated it. And so I can take the money at any point. And I think it's just good stewardship that you update it. And so if you're not
Right.
going to do that, then I'm just going to kind of force your hand. And that's
And
what it took for the organization to like, oh, maybe we should update the bank account.
yeah, and you know, board members at a lot of these charities, this is a volunteer position. You show up to your board meeting once a month, and especially if you're the new board member, Most of the time you're coming in, you're going with the way everything has always been. And so being somebody who's like, wait a minute, we should be looking at the bank statements, not just the financial statements that are being prepared. And so being the one that kind of says that and comes out and fights for that can be put in a difficult position. And even with employees, I mean, you think about it, our entire lives have been told not to be a tattletale, and tattletaling is wrong. And so unless you're creating a culture with either within your organization or within your charity where it's okay to speak up and expected to speak up, and that fraud is not going to be tolerated. I mean, those are the things that we should be telling everybody, as opposed to, don't tattletale.
No, 100%. And I think we've all heard a story or two where, you're the one to draw attention to it, and then all of a sudden you're in a meeting with HR and you're not there anymore. But I want to talk about, you've done a really interesting thing, even in just in my mind, and I do tend to be on the darker side of elegantly detailing a path where your best friend, who is definitely on the up and up, degrades into this individual over the course of the time, and a simple mistake, next thing you know, is stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars. So, can you kind of lay out that story? I believe it was an example in tech that you gave that was ultimately traced back to. Can you kind of explain to people a scenario where any decent human being, given the wrong circumstances, next thing you know, is a criminal?
So this is especially true in something like occupational fraud, and that's when an employee or an employer is stealing from a victim organization. And so almost every case that I have ever, I mean, in every case that I have ever investigated, it has fit into this thing they call the fraud triangle. And so this fraud triangle is, it consists of three different factors. There's pressure, rationalization, and opportunity. And the theory is that all three of these factors have to be present in order for fraud to occur. And so this theory was actually developed back in the 1940s by a guy named Donald Cressy. And he was a criminologist, and he wanted to understand what circumstances caused people to commit, embezzlement. And so he went out and interviewed hundreds of people who were incarcerated for embezzlement. And so this, again, all three factors, there's pressure, rationalization, and opportunity. And so when we talk about people getting into a position where they're committing a crime where that maybe they wouldn't normally do, that's where they have this pressure. And so the pressure could be something like unforeseen medical bills. Could be going through a divorce. It could be, gambling addiction or drug and alcohol addiction, which is something that we see a lot. But the whole idea is that most people are going to require some sort of outside pressure that's going to cause them to commit this criminal act that they wouldn't otherwise normally do. And so, the other two factors I'll just talk about briefly, like rationalization is their ability to explain it in their own mind. So it's their mindset. It's, I need the money, I'll pay it back. That's probably the most common one. A lot of times what we see too is like, I deserve it. Like, I don't get paid enough for all the work that I do, and so I deserve to take this extra money. But the biggest thing here is this opportunity. And so unless somebody has the opportunity to commit crime, then they don't do it. So the scenario that we're talking about, the case study that I have talked about before that I think you're thinking of, it was a guy who was one of three shareholders in a very, very successful company. And he actually went through an IRS audit, and the auditor found indications of fraud, referred it over to the criminal side, and that's where I worked it as a special agent. And this guy, at the end of the day, ended up stealing over $4 million probably altogether. But he went from the first year we discovered he did it was like 10 years prior, and he had like a leaky roof. And granted, a leaky roof is no joke, right? Didn't have the money to pay for it, so he paid it out of the business account and then put it into the general ledger as, like a maintenance expense or something. And he got away with it. Nobody ever looked, nobody ever questioned him about it. And so he ended up, it continued to increase every year. And by the time we caught him 10 years later, he was stealing $1 million a year. And again, if somebody had looked at the bank statements and seen this expense and asked him about it, he probably would have apologized. He probably would have explained the situation about the roof, and he probably would have paid it back. Do you
Well,
think he ever would have stolen again? Like, no, he wouldn't have.
what's interesting too is if he just had a difficult conversation. I mean, you would know more than I would. Is it safe to assume those partners would have just handed him the what? $5,000? $500?
Yeah, it's
$500?
$5,000 the first year.
They probably would just handed it to him, right?
Right.
Distribution or something like that. And then we pay the
Right.
taxes on it and done. And then nobody's out. Which is
That
an
guy ended up
interesting
spending 2
notion.
years in prison for it.
And I just imagine that he struggles to have a difficult conversation. Hey guys, I can't afford to repair my roof. Can you? I'm just profiling them as a little bit oddly enough, is almost kind of like a sweetheart that just ends up. I don't know. So I want to talk about that element. So we're talking about these 3 points of pressure, and it's interesting because this puts me in a world mentally where you've probably seen a lot of this. A lot of people, normal people, criminals, that knew they were criminals. I mean, they may never have expected to get caught, but it's like if you'd bother to sit them down and be like, "You are stealing money. This is known to be fraud, aka you're a criminal, right?"
Well, and again, it's that first time there's this pressure. But
Yeah.
once they get away with it, that's when the greed takes over. And at that point, if somebody's not going to look, why wouldn't I just keep taking money?
When this sounds like cheating a little bit, almost kind of like a universal law, a little bit like cheating in a relationship or I don't know, a poker game or whatever, something like that, or lying, you know what I mean? Where it's like, you get away with this simple fib, and the next thing you know, you're a fibber, and it's not one of those things where it's like they lie once and so thus they're a liar. It's one of those things where it's a slippery slope, right? And then next thing you know, we're not known for telling the truth or getting it done or this, that, the other. Well, I'll bother to bring it up because I think it's very relevant. I had a business partner, and it was definitely an interesting ordeal and a show. And how I embody it in my mind is I once had somebody ask, like, "Hey, he said he's going to do this thing. Do you believe he will do it?" And I sat with that question for a minute in my head, and the answer ultimately was this: he has every intention of doing what he says he's going to do. Will he do it? Is what you're asking me. If that's what you're asking me, no, I do not believe he will do it. I believe in a perfect world with perfect circumstances, he has every intention of doing it. It will get done. But we don't live in a perfect world with perfect circumstances, and thus he won't do it. And so what I want to ask ultimately is this, and I don't know how to phrase it, this question of morality, right? In a world where you've seen people certainly where, and maybe not, maybe this is just because hopefully you wouldn't have seen this person, but we can agree there's people out there that have these three things: pressure, opportunity, and oh shoot, the third one,
Rationalization.
rationalization. Well, I guess they wouldn't have rationalization at that point, would they? They wouldn't have, because I'm trying to envision a world where somebody, they all the right circumstances in there are there, and yet they chose the right thing. And how do we define the right thing? And so again, I really want to find a way to how to ask this, but I guess what I'm asking is, how has this enlightened your moral compass? That's what I'm asking. Have you had moments after the fact where you're like, shoot, I could have done that. I would it, wrong circumstances, I would have been that person. What does
Well,
that say about
sure. I
me,
mean,
and how does that evolve my way of thinking?
yeah, and I think that's probably true for most people. I mean, imagine working at a company and there's a break room and there's just an open box and it's got hundreds of dollars a bill, like hundreds, $100 bills. We'll say that. And so it's just there. It's just there for the open, and you walk by it and you don't take anything, right? And over again, you see it and you're not taking anything. And then what happens if you start noticing that the other $100 are going away? Like somebody is taking it out. And that might be the first time that you would say, like, well, if somebody else is doing it, why wouldn't I do it too? And so it is an interesting scenario to talk about. And I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I would like to think that I wouldn't ever do that. But, if you walk by a $100 bill, it's just nobody cares that it's just sitting there. Nobody's protecting it. And that's why when I, talk about fraud and give presentations, I really try to focus on the opportunity section, because that is the one thing that people can control. You have no ability to control somebody's outside pressures, and you have no ability to control how somebody would rationalize stealing in their mind, right? Those are completely outside of anything that you have any ability to, manipulate or anything. But here's this opportunity, and so somebody is not going to steal from you if they think they're going to get caught. And so that's the perception of detection is something that it's the biggest way to deter fraud from your organization. And so, I mean, think about a bar or restaurant, and all of a sudden they put cameras in on their cash registers. The cameras don't even have to work for the sales to start going up, because it's the perception that somebody would be able to look back and be able to see you stealing. And again, I teach people too, like, even if you have a bookkeeper who does everything for you, have somebody else reconcile the bank accounts. Like, you have to have some eyes on the actual bank transactions, because that's where you would notice it. And so if once a year you look at a bank statement, go ask your bookkeeper a question, even if you know the answer to it. Like, hey, what was this for? Because now they think you're looking at it, and that will deter them from stealing.
Well, and it's super relevant too, because in tech, so we come in for all these different companies, and 9 out of 10 times it is a very standard sort of like, here's the tech company, let's go, blah, blah, blah. But we have had scenarios where we've seen, and it's been the most fascinating thing. And to your point exactly, it's hard to say it hasn't turned out the same way every time, where it's like you're installing the security cameras, and then all of a sudden there's a lot of paranoid individuals. And it's funny because we all say, oh, well, if there's nothing to be afraid of, then what are you worried about? And it's kind of like, for me, if somebody says that, I get nervous, right? Because I'm like, no, you don't say that and have my best interest at heart. But there is some truth to it in that every scenario where the example of the security cameras, most people just don't care. They're like, whatever, right? And then, if they do care, or if there is an atmosphere of paranoia, someone knows they're about to get caught.
Yes. So if you are a small business owner listening to this and you haven't looked at your bank statements in a year, go pull one out and look at it, because that's the only way you'll know if something bad is happening. And most of the cases of fraud that we see, it is right there in the open. It is not hard to find. We're not finding people who are, hiding this in very complex ways. It is right there in the open, and they just know you're not looking at it. Once a year, pull out a bank statement, ask a question.
And the rationalization thing, I want to jump back to a little bit the morality and the rationalization thing, because it's such a fascinating thing to me. Because, I mean, on one hand, we're talking about moral compass and this, that, and the other, and I want to bring up the notion of the Bible and blah, 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 and isn't that a great moral compass? But the reality is, we've seen again and again and again where rationalization in the wrong light, and it's because it's so easy. Somebody slighted me. Why won't I slight somebody else? You gave a perfect example for the $100 missing. Why not me? And I got to hark back a little bit because this is what kind of goes through my mind of setting the stage differently. And I think back, so Tate Fisher was an interview I did, and it was a very interesting thing. I had asked him if he'd ever been bankrupt, and he said no. He said, but we almost went bankrupt. What happened was one of his clients went bankrupt. That would have triggered a bankruptcy for him. He's even gotten consultation that has said, had you had filed for bankruptcy, you would be better off. And there's nothing illegal about bankruptcy, to be clear. But he decided, no, the chain stops here. And what's interesting is he ended up shouldering the burden for someone else, and his vendors, worked with him. But it's an interesting scenario of a situation in where I think all the right ingredients were there, And again, bankruptcy isn't illegal, so what's immoral about it? And I'm not saying bankruptcy is immoral. I'm just saying he personally decided to shoulder that. And so, in the same sort of way, I think it could be applied to moral, right? I think it could be applied to that person stole, so why can't I steal? Or, that person killed my family member, so why can't I kill them? Or, it's this chain of negative events, and you decide to be the one to shoulder the pain instead of passing it off. Anyway,
Right.
I'm sorry, just kind of going into a deep tangent there mentally.
Yeah. Well, and we talk about opportunity a lot, and that's something that I focus on a lot. And one of the things that I have noticed since I've been on my own, so I, as a special agent, didn't get involved in divorce cases, but this is an area that I think needs a lot of help because I think the opportunity is so wide. And people are not providing the right information because nothing happens to them if they don't. And so that is an area that I'm focusing a lot of my energy on and hoping to make a difference in this in this industry because too many people are getting taken advantage of because if their ex-spouse or future ex-spouse decides not to provide the right information, nothing happens to them. And so I want to make this, something that's more approachable for people. And so we've, designed this thing called the Red Flag Analysis, this new product that we're offering. And we're trying to make it, the idea behind it is that if you're going through a divorce and you've got a lot of, piles of financial documents and your gut is telling you something's not right. Maybe you've been on the outside of all the finances in the relationship, or if one of the spouses owns a small business. And what we're doing is we have designed this process where we analyze standard discovery documents that are exchanged. We're focusing on bank statements and tax returns. And we specifically look for signs of suspicious activity. So we look for things like unreported income. We look for hidden assets, hidden bank accounts, and all that type of stuff. And we do all of this for a flat rate fee, which is something that I don't think any other forensic accounting firm out there does. And we do this because, I've built this firm up in the last 4 years, and we now have 180 years of experience as former revenue agents, former revenue officers, former special agents, former forensic accountant with the FBI. We have banking specialists. And so we're able to use all of the experience that we have working financial investigations for the federal government, and we're able to identify issues very effectively. And again, by offering it at a flat rate fee, it's making it more approachable for individuals. And I tell you, we find stuff all the time and things that matter to individuals. I mean, if I make
Well,
an
and it's
income
interesting
adjustment,
too, because that, I mean, a divorce is de facto opportunity. You were married, and that's what you get, 50-50. I mean, there's not really much option there unless you had a lot of paperwork ahead of time, which none of us did because we
right.
jumped into a marriage. And you have pressure, right?
Yes.
And
Pressure
so
in the
now
divorce
all
is.
you need is rationalization. And let's be honest, we probably divorced the person to begin with because maybe they weren't that great at that.
Right. And generally, the people who are hiding the
Let's.
money are the what's that?
I'm sorry, but this is it's a fascinating full circle, right? Because I was just talking about cheating and lying, and that's that person that struggles with rationalization. And that's the exact type of
And
person you divorce, which is the exact type of person that probably hides money.
right. And again, one of the common things that we see is when, the main breadwinner thinks that they deserve more. So that's how they rationalize it the most time. Like, I'm the one who's been working for 20 years, so I deserve to have more money. And so I'm going to hide some assets over here. I'm going to start a new bank account and siphon off some money over here. Or if I pay child support, all the child support is going to go to my ex-spouse and for, things that aren't going to the children. So I'm going to reduce my income and make, not pay as much child support. I mean, there's all kinds of different ways in a divorce that people rationalize in it. And again, the main problem that I'm having in this area is that the opportunity is so big for people to do this because nothing happens to people if they decide not to provide bank records for a certain account. or hide money or reduce their income because of because they're a small business owner and they get to. I mean, the it's an area that we are trying to create a lot of awareness about. It's an area that we're trying to notify attorneys as well as individuals that this is available because we do think that we can make a huge difference. I mean, if you think about it, child support's based on income in almost every state. And so if somebody, especially a small business owner, if they're able to reduce or misrepresent their income and we bump them up from say 100,000 to 200,000 annually, child support will be based on that 200,000, and that's going to be for several years. And so these are things that are going to last for a long time in somebody's life and can make a really big difference. And so we're just, this is something that I'm really passionate about, and I'm trying everything I can to talk about it and inform people and again, make it something that people can afford. And so the whole idea with offering at a flat rate is like, let's decide right off the bat if it's worth it to spend the money to bring on somebody for the details, right? To actually be an expert witness. And if we don't find anything, you get peace of mind. Now you can move on.
Yeah. That's got to be particularly difficult in a crypto world, in a Bitcoin world, getting the relevant records, I would
It certainly
assume,
can be,
too.
yes.
Unless you know of a pretty good, I mean, I guess it really just all depends. There's plenty of legitimate vehicles where you can subpoena a legitimate agency and they're going to hand over records.
One of the big areas that we're seeing is the peer-to-peer transactions. So it's
Yeah.
the Venmo, the Cash App, the PayPal. And if you're an attorney listening to this, like please get out your standard discovery request right now and add that to it because PayPal is a bank account. Venmo is a bank account.
Yeah.
You can hold a balance in there. You can transfer money from one account to another account. You can get a credit, you can get a debit card for it. You can get statements for it.
Yeah. You definitely can. You definitely can. And the cool thing about Bitcoin, even to your point exactly, and this is where I think there's going to be a shift at some point, or there should be. I don't know whether there will or not, because it would be a drastic shift to focusing on net worth versus net income. Because net worth, if somebody buys a very big house, right? Oh, I don't have any Bitcoin, but Bitcoin went up drastically and I just bought a big home. And it's kind of like, okay. Sure, you didn't have any Bitcoin, and yet it went up a lot, and you bought a big home, and you didn't make a lot of income, and you don't have a lot of securities. So, where'd it come from?
And I tell you, we base all of our income adjustments and divorces based on IRS laws. So we can do these cases in any state in the US. It doesn't matter. Again, we base it on tax returns and what an IRS agent would do.
Yeah. That's fantastic. So, this has been awesome. I could keep going for a while. But we probably should wind it down at some point. I like to ask, so there's two questions now. I think I'm trying to narrow down and standardize this. So the first one is, we have a motto over here that goes, if we have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. Who's been a giant in your life that's helped to build you to be the person you are?
Well, first and foremost, I have to give all, I mean, so much credit to my father, who is my biggest mentor. He was a business guy. He's the guy I go to for advice on everything. He's, can you see my smile?
Yeah, I love it.
Yes. So he above and beyond more than anybody else. And what's interesting is it's his father that probably was that for him. And I think back now, and I wish I had known my grandfather in a different way because, I was just younger when, and I just think I could have learned a ton from him too. And then the second person that I'm going to say is Rick Mayner of CFO Systems, who has become a mentor of mine and is just, he is the reason that you and I met because he introduced me to the B2B networking group. And even today he's still a mentor to me and provides me guidance and have to give him a lot of credit too.
That's fantastic.
That's a good
So,
question. I
thank
like that
you.
one.
So the second question is, if you were to, a general rule of thumb, something you learned, an idea, a concept that seems to hold true and has helped you weather storms. Do you have something you learned along the way that's just like, maybe it's even just a pithy saying or something that just again and again and again through each storm you found to be true and has helped?
Well, I live in a college town now, and a lot of times, and I probably give this unsolicited to some of the college kids here, but I think that the secret to life is to learn how to ask people questions, because it's natural. Like every human being wants to be heard, wants to be understood, and the more that you can put that energy into somebody else, that people really seem to latch onto that. And so I just in general try to ask lots of people lots of questions, and that seems to have done pretty well for me.
I hate to add to that, but that is such a good sentiment. And there's two fantastic sides to that. I've had people I've been talking to where, and it's not to be rude, I love listening to them, and it's part of the reason that I ask questions. But there's been moments where it's like, man, if I could get in a word edgewise, I could probably help you. You've got all these questions and I have the answers to them, but I can't, you're not letting me talk. And then the other side of it, right? And so then he doesn't know what I do, and he doesn't know if I can help or not. And so it's like, that's tough. And then the
Yes.
second side of it is, it's funny when I'm talking, maybe even to my mentors, I know they can help. The difficult thing is, what question should I be asking? What, because probably more so than me, that there, especially having worked for the IRS for 10 years, there is something out there that people are assuming that if they just asked you, you'd be like, oh, you don't know that? Oh, that's really easy. It's like this. So anyway, but I appreciate it. So Krista,
Well,
how can we get a hold of you? How can we plug in to Focus Forensic Solutions?
so the best way to get a hold of me is just through the website, which is focused with an ED forensic.com. And there's an easy way to connect with us on there. We just revamped the website. We've got a couple of videos that will be on there that kind of explain what we do. List of all the team members that we have, the types of cases that we do. And then, of course, there's the way to send us an email through that form.
I love it. I love
Yeah.
it.
And before we go,
Yeah.
if you will allow me, like I want to talk about you for a second because, I've been with Lock. How long have I been with Lockbaud now? A couple years?
It's been a little bit, yeah. Whatever
Yeah.
that first meeting was some time ago, it's been at least probably a
Yeah.
couple of years, yeah.
And as a small business owner, especially somebody who deals with the financial, parts of people's lives. So we have a lot of tax returns and a lot of bank statements. And to have our service, like, you provide our IT service and we feel so comfortable with it, with our information being protected. But more than anything else, if I have a problem with something, I call or I email and you guys take care of us right away. So I just want to give you a big shout out for that because it is, I couldn't say enough good things about you and your company. And if anybody's in need of IT service, there's nobody I would refer more than you.
Too kind. Thank you so much,
Well,
Krista, and thank you for joining us.
yes.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.